Before moving on to chapter 17, which is where we are this morning, I want to make a couple comments about what we've already done. In particular, last time, the parallel was drawn between Yishmael and Esav. And I read during the week a comment that really suggests an interesting way of thinking about Isaac in particular, which is that it could be that Isaac suffered his whole life from the fact that he didn't have his older brother. Remember, Ishmael was kicked out of the house. We never thought about how Ishmael was to Isaac. We know how Ishmael was to Sarah, but it could be, you know, that growing up under the shadow of the brother who was never there, or who was only there for a little while and then was kicked out for good, because he's going to be kicked out for good in another chapter, affected Isaac so much that he was drawn to Esau precisely because he was like Ishmael. He was like the brother that he never had, but should have had, which is a very interesting thought. I don't know. I mean, there isn't that much in the text about it, but it certainly is suggestive, because there's something about Ishmael and Esav that makes them feel paired in a lot of ways, not just because one marries into the family of the other, but just also just in terms of their both being sort of primal forces of life, you know, hunters, elemental people, so on. And so maybe what Isaac was drawn to is, you know, when you deliberately exile something from your emotional life or from your family life, it always sneaks in the back door, right? It's not like it stays out forever. So it may be that what happened here was that because Isaac worked so hard, or Rebekah really worked so hard to push Esav out, Ishmael out, he came back in Isaac's life in another guise. Anyway, it's an interesting thought. Now, when last we left all of our biblical characters, Hagar had been thrown out, and then the angel had sent her back. And she was grateful that she was able to see an angel and live, El Roi, the God who is seen, or the God who sees. And then she comes back and gives Abraham a son, still Abram, he's about to be Abraham, and calls him Ishmael, which is the name that the angel told her he should be called. And Abram was 86 when Hagar gives birth to Ishmael. Now, in terms of the ages of people in the Bible, what's that? Says Abraham was 46? Four score means 20. A score is 20. So that's 86, right. This, by the way, plays a very important part, for those of you who don't know it, in the most, the most famous speech in American history, which is the Gettysburg Address, which opens, right, and 7 years ago, which means 87 years ago, because it was 87 years after the nation was founded that the Civil War that the Gettysburg Address was delivered, actually, not that the Civil War began. Okay. It's not. It's just the use of score. I'm just saying that's what, yeah.
How old was Hagar?
Doesn't say. It doesn't say. I don't know. Which is also, yeah. No, it doesn't. Which is also, by the way, although this is completely irrelevant to everything we're talking about, also the basis of one of Bob Newhart's great routines. Bob Newhart, those of you who don't know, is a comedian who has this routine where he plays Abraham Lincoln's publicist, and he's on the telephone. And he says to him, Abe, nobody knows a score. 87 years ago, Abe. Trust me. Begin with 87 years ago. It's very funny. And Abe, lose the beard. So it's a great routine.
It's interesting, the one that perhaps the greatest American novel, some say,
Mm-hmm. Begins, "Call me Ishmael." Yep, it does. It does indeed.
He's saying more than saying hello.
Yeah, that is true. Right, that's a famous opening of Moby Dick, is "Call me Ishmael." And And the only thing that I would say is in that novel, he's clearly, he's the one who survives. Remember, he's the one who tells the tale. So I don't know what that says, but anyway, so Abraham is 86 years old, which means in terms of biblical ages, remember, to the extent to which they're supposed to be taken literally is an open question, but it clearly does mean that he's supposed to be thought of as very old. Beyond even normal childbearing years, although it will get worse when Isaac is born. Okay, now, 13 years pass without any comment. Presumably Ishmael grows up. We don't know what treatment he's subject to by Sarah. We don't know what treatment he's subject to by Avraham. I think it's to be assumed that Hagar is a loving mother. But now we go to chapter 17. And once again, it is the silences, of course, in the book that make it so amenable to, I have no idea. I don't know. It sounds like the heavens are falling.
Also, Rabbi, it doesn't say like Hagar was sent out, so how come she was welcome back?
It doesn't say she was welcome back. It just says she was taken back.
If she's thrown out.
It doesn't say. Presumably, she came back and she's about to give birth, and Avram said, right, you can't throw her back out, she'll die, and Sarah... You can't imagine that Sarah was too happy about this. So,
it was a second chance for both Sarah and Avram to consider all the...
It was, and maybe a generous reading of this is that the 13 years suggests that they did okay, because this was their second chance, and maybe during those 13 years they were all right, although, as you see, once Isaac is born, Sarah banishes Ishmael forever. So it's very, remember what we said last time, that the part of the lesson that the rabbis derive from this is you shouldn't make promises that in the end, even though they're well-intentioned, you can't keep. It's what I say to bride and grooms when they want to do their own vows, is that if they want to do their own vows, it's okay, but don't make vows that aren't real under the chuppah. Don't say, I will never hurt you, because it's not true. Not only is it not true, but everybody who's there who's been married will know that what you're saying under the chuppah isn't true. You can say, I will always, you know, if I hurt you, I will always, you know, seek your forgiveness. That you can do, because sooner or later you probably will. But you can't say I'll never hurt you. And so maybe this was, you know, Sarah said, go ahead, have a kid by him. I'll be okay. But she couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it. All right. I was just reading this novel called The Eighth Day by Thornton Wilder, and this guy sees somebody who's really on the run because he's escaped from a murder charge, but he thinks the person who runs into him thinks he had a fight with his wife, and that's why he's wandering around, that she threw him out of the house, and he said, it doesn't matter what happened, just go back and say, I'm sorry. So, wise words from a... Chapter 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am El Shaddai. Walk in my ways and be blameless. Now, this, we could spend a long time, and probably will spend at least a reasonable amount of time just on this single sentence. First of all, why 99? The rabbis conclude that what this is trying to teach you is that it's never too late. Everybody always assumes, can't change my life now, can't be different now, can't teach an old dog new tricks, which is an English proverb. But in fact, here's Abram, and his whole life is about to change at age 99. You know, Grandma Moses, who became a renowned painter, didn't learn to paint until she was in her 80s. So who knows? Immanuel Kant was probably the most important philosopher of modern times, didn't write a single book worth remembering till he was in his 50s. So it's always possible. Look, Rabbi Akiva didn't start learning until he was in his 40s, and he became Rabbi Akiva. So the idea that we're done is contradicted. I mean, better than any of them is Avram, who starts at age 99. Right? And his whole life is about to change, and one of the commentators, Samson Raphael Hirsch, has a long comment on this, and it's actually a very beautiful comment. And I thought about bringing it, but it's too long to read. And let me give you the essence of what he says. He says, why is it now that God has to say to Abram, come before me and be blameless? He says, you know, look at everything he's already been through. And God already gave him a promise. And he's already faced, you know, this trial and that trial and childlessness and so on. And Hirsch says that's because there are two levels here. One is the level of being a human being, and the other is the level of being a Jew. Up to now, Avram has been trained as a human being, but that's not the same thing as being trained as a Jew. And what God wants from him, since he's supposed to be a paradigm, right? He is the first Jew. It's not enough if he's a good guy. He has to now be ushered into what it is to be part of a covenantal people. He has to learn what it is to be a Jew. And so up to now, it's been one thing to train Avram, but walk before me and be blameless, that's a whole new story. He also says, which many of the commentators, there's a nice Hasidic commentary about why God says, walk before me and be blameless. One of the Hasidic rabbis says that's because the only way to be blameless is to walk in front of people. Once you get in the midst of people, it's impossible to be blameless, which I think is a very significant comment. That is, if you want to separate yourself from other people, then maybe you don't. But inside, in the midst of people, it's not possible. Now, this one says, walk in my ways. But hitalech lefanai, literally in Hebrew, is walk before me. Lefanai is before me. Okay. Really, what does it mean? The Jewish Publication Society translation assumes that what it really means is walk in my ways. The classical Midrashic comment you can find by looking, hold it. This is a nice comment, and you may not remember it from before, so let me, if you turn to, hold it. One second. Where is it? It says, that Noah walked with God. And I'm looking for the pasuk, which I have unaccountably lost. And if anybody can find it before me, you don't get a prize. But if I had a prize, I would give it to you. It's Ima Elohim Hitalech Noach, and it should be right there. Oh, there it is. Okay, right. Sorry. Et Elohim Hitalech Noach. Yeah, 6:9, the very beginning of the Parsha of Noach. It says, this is the line of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. He was blameless in his age. Noah walked with God. Okay? And then it says, Abraham walked in front of God. So the rabbinic comment is, if you are small and weak and you need the support of your parent, you walk with your parent. If you are strong and independent and you know who you are, you can walk in front. Abraham and Noah were different in that way. Noah needed God's support. That's why he walked with God. Abraham, on the other hand, was a strong character, so he could walk before God. But the literal meaning I couldn't tell you.
Could it also be that Abraham walked, when you stand before somebody while in their sight, in their vision, that he was answerable to God, that he walked in the way of God?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That God was watching him, so to speak, or that, you know.
That God had his back, you know, yeah. Because God was behind him. Yeah, that's another way of thinking about it. If you walk in front of God, that means God is behind you.
You're covered.
You're covered, exactly. Exactly. You know, that's how Moshe sees God. When Moshe sees God, remember, what does he see? He sees God's back. Right. The Chafetz Chaim was a very famous rabbi of the end of the 19th, early 20th century, lived until right before the Second World War. He was probably the most famous traditional rabbi in the world. And I heard once that Mr. Mermel had seen the Chafetz Chaim, so I asked him about it. And he said he was once at this Jewish conference in the 20s, I think, in Eastern Europe, and the Chafetz Chaim was there, which is why everybody came. He said, and I saw the Chafetz Chaim walking away. He said, so I saw him as Moses sees God. I only saw his back, which I thought was a beautiful... anyway, so that's how... So Abraham walks before God. And God says, I am El Shaddai. Now, what is El Shaddai? I'm going to first give you the scholarly comment. This is the most common of several divine names constructed with an El, like El Elyon. This is El Shaddai. And it's not clear exactly what it means, but... He says that it's, the name would originally have meant, since Shadu in Akkadian means mountain, it could mean the one of the mountain, or corresponding to our idea, we call God the rock, right? Tzur Mishalo Achalnu. So it could also mean Almighty, the strong one, the highest, but Shaddai, what does Dai mean in Hebrew? Enough, right. So the rabbis talk about El Shaddai as the one who sets limits. That is, either the way the Torah Tumimah has it is God created the world and then said, that's enough, I'm not creating anymore. From now on, it's the human responsibility to continue creating. In other words, God didn't finish creating the world. God is the one who created and then said, that's it. Now human beings have to finish creation. That's why we're partners in creation. Or maybe and, it could be the God who teaches people how to set boundaries. And here Hirsch says that all of Judaism is contained in knowing when to say die, when to say stop, when to say enough, what you can't do, how to set boundaries. That in fact, it's in restraint and boundaries that Judaism lives. So that's a very interesting way of thinking about it. You may think that that's a negative way of thinking about it, and perhaps it is, but I'm not sure that it isn't a very helpful way. What is within those boundaries can be described in positive terms, but ultimately a life has to be lived within boundaries. I always say to... One of my standard talks to college students is that the only word that grants you freedom in this world is no. Without no, you're a slave. Not only without being able to speak no, but being able to speak no and feeling all right about it. Because some of us say no, but we torture ourselves that we said no, right? But being able to say no and being okay with saying no is a way of recognizing your own limitations, including, by the way, the limitation of your time. Because for everything that you say yes to, it also means you must therefore say no to lots of other things, even if you don't actually say it. So, yeah.
Why is the name Shaddai or the Shin used on the mezuzah rather than the other names of God?
Well, first of all, it's economical. It's only three letters. You wrap it on tefillin as well, and I think the truth is it would probably be very hard to wrap a Yud-Heh Vav-Heh on tefillin. I don't know how you would do it, so Shaddai works. But it may also be because of this, because this is how God reveals himself at the outset of the covenant to Abraham and says explicitly, that's who I am. I am El Shaddai. And I'm guessing of all of them, that's probably the strongest of the, you know, this is when God says that I'll establish my covenant and you have to be with me and all of that. Yeah.
Well, is that principle like one of differentiation between holy, Kodesh Bechol, the holy?
Which principle?
The principle of setting
boundaries. Setting boundaries.
It means differentiation between Jew and non-Jew.
Well, that's a really, you could make an argument that all of Judaism is based on those distinctions, like Havdalah, which means distinction. And remember, in Havdalah, you say Bein Kodesh L'Chol, as you said, between sacred and non-sacred, let's say. Bein Or L'Choshech, between light and darkness. Bein Yom HaShvi'i L'Sheshet Yemei HaMaaseh, between the Sabbath and the other days of the week. Bein Yisrael V'Amim, between Israel and the nations. All of those distinctions. So, which is also, by the way, enshrined in Jewish law. Remember, you're not supposed to mix two different kinds of seeds together. You're not supposed to yoke an ox and an ass together. You're not supposed to wear wool and linen together. All those things. And in fact, this is a very popular theory of kashrut. Developed by an anthropologist named Mary Douglas, who wrote a book on Leviticus, in which she says that you know, all these laws about kashrut, which are very hard to understand. Why fins and scales? Right? Why does a kosher animal have to have a split hoof and chew its cud? Her analysis is that an animal that has a split hoof and chews its cud is kind of the pure mammal. That's what an animal is supposed to be. A cow is kind of a paradigm for what an animal is supposed to be. And anything that deviates from that, just like your basic fish has fins and scales. Things that don't have fins and scales, they may be sea creatures. That's why we call it seafood and we don't call it fish, because it's not a fish somehow. And it suggests that there's some kind of mixing. You know, a lobster is a land creature and a sea creature. A crab is a land creature and a sea creature. But we only eat things that are sort of in the straight line of the way they're supposed to be, because you're not supposed to confuse the lines of God's creation. I don't know if this is in fact what's behind kashrut or not, but it's a theory that certainly has a lot to do with what the Jewish tradition is about. That is, we do draw lines, and the blurring of boundaries is uncomfortable for much of Judaism. So that's possible, yeah. Miriam. I think shed, as in a spirit or a demon or something like that, it's a much later word. I'm pretty sure that it's a much later, I can check it, and Evan Choshan has the, when they came into the language. But midrashically, it's a great comment, because, you know, the midrash, especially the Kabbalah, talks about God's sitra achra, the other side of God, what you Jungian would call the shadow side of God. So if you want to see a demonic power in God, you could certainly see shed in Shaddai, and it would be a great midrash. I mean, don't, you know, we say in the prayers, Oseh Shalom Uvorei Et Hakol, but that's not what Isaiah says about God. We misquote Isaiah. What Isaiah says is Oseh Shalom Uvorei Ra, God who makes peace and creates evil. Why does Isaiah say that God creates evil? Because as far as Isaiah is concerned, God makes everything. There is evil, therefore God must create evil. So, yeah.
Thank you for mentioning that. I find that statement very, very broad. And I think by the discussion, wonderful reading that it's really right. Satisfying me. Because, you know,
right, I think so too. This is why There was a very telling critique, and I've discussed it with him, that the answer doesn't matter, but the critique is important. When Harold Kushner published When Bad Things Happen to Good People, in which he basically said, actually it's one of his lines, God's not in the accident, God's in the ambulance, right? It's not in the bad, but in the good that you find God. So Andre Unger, who is a rabbi in New Jersey, very learned and interesting guy, published a review of it in which he said the problem with this is that it's dualism. Because if God's not in the accident, then how did the accident happen? Either there's another power that creates the world, which is dualism, right? There are two powers, or God's in the accident. You can't get out of that. So that's what Isaiah is saying, is you can't only associate God with good unless you think God is limited. Somehow you have to come to terms with why God is in the bad, and that's another question for another time. But the idea is that everything that's bad has to have God in it as well. And by the way, that's clearly the Bible's doctrine, because everything that's bad that happens in the Bible, either God causes or God permits to happen, which is why people say, you know, we'll be better now, so don't let this happen to us again. Now, why that is a hard question, but yeah. The usual chronology is that Abraham is about 1500 BCE and the Exodus is about between 12 and 1300 BCE. So 200, 250 years, something like that. Although 400 years if you want to count the, yeah.
Would that have transpired into the ultimate boundaries for the
Jews? I think that there are developing rules here. God doesn't expect from Abraham exactly what God expects from Moshe because all the rules haven't been laid down. Abraham hasn't been circumcised yet. He's about to be circumcised, but that's clearly a very powerful Jewish boundary. So yeah, it takes a while before the people are ready for boundaries, you know, just as developing kids are ready for boundaries. I mean, Abraham has already gone so far beyond the society around him that you have to bring them along bit by bit, so to speak.
Last week or 2 weeks ago, we heard Justice Breyer talk about the use of the Supreme, what to do in the Supreme Court. And he said, our job is to greet the boundaries.
Is to what?
Recognize the boundaries and determine whether we're going to change them
right, or
leave them where they are.
Yeah.
Which leads me to wonder whether or not the concept of the Ten Commandments are our Constitution. It's a set of boundaries. We live within that, but there are boundaries, and there are things outside of those boundaries, so that if you're right, and it sounds to me like it may be, Shaddai is an extremely powerful.
Well, what is the word?
He's not defined.
Right. What does the word transgression mean?
Cross over.
To cross over the boundaries, right? Transgression is another English word for crime or sin, and what it literally means is to go over the boundary. Yes, boundaries are... there are two ways of viewing boundaries. Do you know Rousseau, who said, you know, he begins his confessions that man is born free but is everywhere in chains, because he thinks that, in fact, it's people who make boundaries, and they make them, and they're negative. And he said that the greatest criminal in history was the first person who put a rope around the property and said, mine. Okay? But the Bible doesn't, I don't think the Bible agrees with Rousseau. I think the Bible assumes that, in fact, boundaries are intrinsic to being a human being, that you can't live without boundaries, that the notion of living without boundaries is to live in chaos, not to live in freedom. And in fact, that's, you know, every society that has ever lived has found that. If you think, what's wrong with Iraq today? The problem is there aren't enough boundaries, not there are too many boundaries, right? It went from having boundaries that were bad, that had bad, ill-defined boundaries, to having none. And a society without boundaries is in trouble. What makes America work is, to some extent, that people actually stop at red lights. So you do need that. And remember, God, Moshe especially, God, Abraham, Moshe are coming into worlds in which there aren't laws, boundaries, so on, and they have to set them up. So yeah, I would say El Shaddai is, especially in a chaotic world, a particularly important name. But the later tradition does do a lot of playing with boundaries. There's no doubt about it. And boundaries are very tricky, like who is a Jew is a very tricky boundary, right? Somebody who's raised Jewish by two parents, neither of whom are legally Jewish, and accepts Judaism and practices Judaism by Jewish law isn't a Jew. Somebody who has a Jewish mother and is raised as a Christian and practices Christianity by Jewish law is a Jew. Boundaries are very tricky things. They're not perfect. They're slippery. But that's, you know, that's the nature of having boundaries. They're never as absolute as we would like. So, yeah. Right. Well, that's true, too. That's another. Exactly. I agree. I don't think kashrut was for health reasons. I think that that's, you know, as again, to invoke Harold Kushner, as he said when he was here, you can get just as sick from a bad chicken as you can from a bad pig. Right. I mean, you know, it's not like only pigs make you sick. Chickens can make you sick, too. So I don't believe that it was for health. But that's absolutely true that a lot of rules are explained in the Jewish tradition as b'chukotehem lo telechu. That is, you shouldn't walk in their ways because you should be separate, distinct from them, and kashrut clearly separates the Jewish people. A very famous practice, by the way. This is very interesting. For most of Jewish history, most Jews did not cover their heads. They covered their heads sometimes when they prayed, but in the Bible, in the Talmud, there is no evidence of anything like a kippah. Even in the Middle Ages, people didn't wear a kippah all the time. And German Jews, even to modern times, often didn't wear a kippah. Some of my father's most traditional teachers, like Louis Ginzburg, who was a very, very traditional Jew, would put his kippah on, say the bracha, take his kippah off, eat, put his kippah on, say Birkat HaMazon. It was only in about the 17th, 18th century that the practice of wearing a kippah started to become widespread, and the rationale for it was b'chukotehem lo telechu, so that you would distinguish yourself from the non-Jews. That's why. That was the purpose. The purpose was so that everybody would know that you're a Jew. Yes? It's very hard, is the answer to that. It's very hard because we give our kids a very mixed message. You know, you should live in the best neighborhoods and go to the best schools and get jobs in the best places and go to the best colleges, but don't fall in love. It's a very hard message. And I would say this is the argument of Jews in Israel, which is since you can't do it, you really can't do it, you better live here. And also the argument of Jews who separate themselves, you know, and who live essentially in all Jewish neighborhoods and shop at all Jewish stores and so on, because they say any mixture is fatal. But it's difficult, yeah. Well, it certainly is true that it's a different, it's very different in a monotheistic world, in a world of Islam and Christianity from what it was in the time of Abraham. No doubt about it. That's why, I mean, look, if there are cults, small cults of idol worshippers in America, no Jew gets particularly upset because we live in a society which is essentially monotheistic. The question, though, is does Judaism still have something of importance to say to the world? And if it does, the answer, I think, to what Marcy was saying is you can't say that to the world if you isolate yourself from it. That is, I don't think the non-Jewish world learns very much from the Jews in Borough Park because they don't speak to each other. They learn much more from a Jew like Joseph Lieberman, who doesn't imagine if he had decided not to have any relationship with a non-Jewish world. It would be a great loss. So, yeah.
Which brings me to the point of what Marx wrote about on the question of the Jews. Was it because we separated ourselves that the world treated us?
Yeah, but that's, I think that that's both untrue and also typical of somebody who is angry at his own roots and hates his own people. This is Marx's point about that because the Jews separated themselves, the world hated them. There are many, 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 many groups in history. But I'm saying there are many groups in history who have separated themselves and who have their own unique. The world doesn't hate the Pennsylvania Dutch. They separated themselves much more extravagantly than the Jews did, right? In fact, the world often admires people who separate themselves. The Shakers, the Quakers. There are lots of groups that separate themselves throughout history. The Jews are hardly the only group that separated themselves. The hatred comes from something else. Part of it is, you know, I wish I had that small letter with me. It's wonderful. Remember that it's interesting. Jews aren't only hated for separating themselves. Jews are hated for being capitalists and communists, for being separate and for assimilating, for being too retiring and quiet and for being too full of chutzpah and being loudmouth. There is nothing for which the Jews are not hated. And as soon as you say they're hated for this, you realize they've also been hated for the opposite. So every explanation that says people, I mean, look, in Eastern Europe, the Jews were hated because they were separate. And yet, when the gates fell and they assimilated and they came into Soviet society, they were hated twice as much, right? So, in fact, this was, I'll tell you, that's all right. This is important stuff. When I wrote a review of Mel Gibson's movie, I started off the review by quoting my teacher, who unfortunately has died at an early age. He was a wonderful and a brilliant man, Amos Funkenstein. He said, in modern societies, people who hate Jews will not identify traditional Jews as the objects of their hate. They will always identify assimilated Jews as the objects of their hate, because it is not permitted to identify traditional Jews. It is only permitted to talk about assimilated Jews. And now, if you don't understand what he means, listen to what Mel Gibson said. All those secular Jews are taking the religion out of Hollywood. That's exactly what Funkenstein was talking about. Mel Gibson would never say, I hate those traditional Jews, because that's clear anti-Semitism. Instead, what you do is you focus on Jews who are doing something else, because they're assimilated, and you focus on whatever it is, the something else they're doing. I hate those Jews who are sharp businessmen. Because then you're not hating Jews, you're hating the fact that they're sharp businessmen. I hate the Jews who are taking religion out of Hollywood. Because it's not that you would love it if they were religious Jews. It's that they're taking the religion out of Hollywood. So you can hear the accent of the hater sometimes precisely in the fact that they don't identify being Jewish as the problem. It's always the other things that the Jews are doing. And as soon as Mel Gibson said that, I got nervous about his movie, even before it came out. But anyway, yeah.
Would the ultimate be when the Jews were so assimilated before the Nazis took power in Germany?
It's a perfect example. A perfect example. German Jews were so assimilated. They were intermarried all over the place. And so you would think, obviously, there would be no hatred. But, yeah.
Same thing happened in the Inquisition.
Right. Yes.
Prime ministers, doctors.
Yep. Exactly. It's another great example. Remember, Abravanel, who was the leader of the Jewish community, took care of the finances of the regime. Ferdinand and Isabella hatched a plan to kidnap his grandson to keep Abravanel in Spain because they needed his talents. But they found out about it and left in the middle of the night. Yes.
Yeah.
I will tell you, the question is of envy and jealousy. I will tell you what I think of as the great secret of anti-Semitism, which is there is no single explanation. There are people who hate Jews who are not jealous of Jews. There are people who hate Jews who are jealous of Jews.
Okay.
I mean, Chaim Maccabee, for example, had a wonderful, I think of this, this doesn't fit into the jealousy thing at all, but this is a very powerful explanation of anti-Semitism. He asked, he was an English scholar, very interesting, provocative scholar. He said, why is it that anti-Semitism makes Jews both superhuman and subhuman? They control the world, but they're vermin, right? How could that be? So this is his answer. He says the superhuman part comes from the history of Christian anti-Semitism, because what did the Jews do in the history of Christianity? They killed God, and you can't kill God if you're a normal human being. You have to be superhuman to kill God. So there always was, he said, in Christian anti-Semitism, this strain of the Jews are superhuman. After all, they killed God. I mean, think about that, killing God, right? So there's so much in it and so much history in it that I don't think any, because Jews have been hated when they were downtrodden and poor, just as when they were successful and smart and rich. It's mind-boggling. It is just mind-boggling, yes. It is what, I just want to say, what Stanley Crouch, who is a black critic and a wonderful writer and a very good friend, he calls it a protean hatred. Protean means it takes lots and lots of forms. He says it doesn't matter what it is that you hate, you can hate the Jews for it. Because they've done it. Yeah.
I think it's precisely the strength of Judaism that it can put boundaries and differentiate between black and white at the one time. And it's simultaneously, they see all the graduations of grays that exist. And it's the most famous thing is that the Jew says, it depends.
Right, exactly.
It's not putting a boundary.
That's right. I agree. If you can only do boundaries, you're too rigid. But if you can explore them and discuss them, that's a good point. Because the whole history of questioning and argument doesn't seem to go so well with boundaries, but it does. Go ahead.
Both at the same time. And I think that the strength of Judaism is often that it puts paradoxical ideas, that it can hold both of those ideas at the same time in its head and not say that, you know, have to choose between one or the
right.
other, but I think we do this in many spheres of life, and I think that that's perhaps where our strength comes from.
I think that is true, and well, very well put. Okay, one more comment, and then go ahead.
Let's go back to Shaddai.
Yes.
I don't know Hebrew as well as a lot of people here, but there's something about breast and Shaddai, which is ironic, because I'd never heard it divided the way you did. Shaddai, which is about boundaries, but Shad would be giving and
Shadayim are breasts. I don't know if it's from the same root, though, which you would have to check to know if it's, and I suspect it's not, but it's it's an interesting coincidence in how it sounds, but remember, we have to be careful about being too, I mean, midrashically you can, but it doesn't mean that there's a real connection any more than there's a real connection between real, the word reality, and real, a reel on a tape. They sound the same, but it doesn't mean that they're really, yeah.
Building on that concept, if we take die meaning enough, could it also, instead of only talking about boundaries, could it also say, God also be saying, I am enough for you?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. You don't need other gods. You don't need other gods. I'm sufficient. I'm the all-sufficient God. Right. I like that. Let's do at least one more sentence before we wrap it up for the vacation. That's all right. You know, there's nothing. Listen, Mark Twain used to say he spent all morning putting a comma in and all afternoon taking it out. So there's no reason why we can't spend all day on a sentence. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will make you exceedingly numerous, which means that the covenant was not yet established. And how does it get established? Circumcision. Those of you, was anybody here in Lunch and Learn this past? Okay, so this is a much longer discussion, but we'll have it next time, actually, because we're beginning with circumcision to some extent. But I just reviewed a book called Marked in Your Flesh, all about the history of circumcision and the question of whether circumcision is medically mandated or not. And I'm not going to go through it all. You can all get the lunch and learn if you want to hear more about it, or we'll talk about it perhaps next time. But it does remind us that that in some way, Abraham has so far done nothing irrevocable to mark his change from what he was to what he is. He could always go back to idolatry, right? But once he's circumcised, that's irrevocable. He can still go back to idolatry, but he's marked forever as somebody who's changed his life. So it could be that what God is saying here is, you know, that part of a boundary is the inability then to go back over it if you've crossed it, certain boundaries anyway. And Avram is now, even though it's true, he's changed his life radically, obviously. He moved from his home. He's, you know, divided up the area, or will divide up the area with his child. He'll have an offspring to give his child to, and Lot has taken something, and he saved Lot and all of that. But still, he still could go back to what he was. And in a minute, he's about to take a step at age 99, no less, that is not something that can change. Yeah.
Would you consider that the first boundary?
Well, I don't know. It depends how you think of the boundary, but you could. You could, I suppose. Actually, the first boundary is the boundary to the Garden of Eden. That's the first boundary. And that one, again, human beings learned what it was to transgress and to lose and to not be able to return. So, yeah. Well, the rabbis talk about that. Their comment is that exactly what God says here, become perfect. Not you are perfect, but become perfect. And that it requires human cooperation, human effort to perfect God's. But this is a long topic, the topic of Brit Milah, of circumcision. And we will take it up next time after the break, which is its own kind of boundary. The next class is January 5th, whatever that Thursday is.